Good morning and welcome to another episode of In Conversation with Rashmi on CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. My guests in studio this morning is Natasha McKenty and Joanna Rickert Hall. My first guest today will begin with Natasha McKenty. She is the host of an urban magazine show in studio, feature writer for 570's Kitchener Today and public relations consultant. Natasha has a thirst for delivering all that her community has to offer. She is a passionate storyteller driven by the desire to communicate to an audience. Natasha created McKenty Media as an opportunity to combine the transferable skills she cultivated during her career in television broadcasting with her recent education in PR. She is an active part of her community, an advocate for the underdog, and a passionate leader. Her experience as a producer, journalist, writer, mother, and a communicator propelled her to find her calling, public relations. Natasha, it's an absolute pleasure having you here in studio this morning. Thank you for joining me. Your interest in talking and hosting shows began at a really early age. So how and where did it all begin?
I had two siblings and we were separated when we were very young, so then I became an only child. So I think that's where my creativity came from, just trying to entertain myself and rewrite my own story.
And you were interviewing your family, your...
What I would do is I would actually line up all of my dolls and I would do interviews. I didn't play school or house. I always hosted my own show. That is what I did. And so, you know, sometimes we outgrow those passions we have when we're 8 years old, but I didn't for some reason. I just, that's what I wanted. And then I went into I took television broadcasting when I started when I was just 18.
Okay.
And I took a 2-year program and I was employed at CTV before I turned 20.
And did you have someone who inspired you? Did you look up to somebody that to say, okay, this is what I want to do. This is where I need to be.
There was no one person. I think, I don't know. And I listen to a lot of podcasts now and it's interesting to hear that a lot of people who end up in an industry like broadcasting or acting or performing, mm-hmm. They always had something when they were younger that they were trying to escape from or rewrite in some way. Mm-hmm. And that's where their creativity came from. So for me, I knew I wanted to be in broadcasting, but in my early 20s, I had a band. I sang in a band for 4 years. I took acting at Seneca in Toronto. I thought I was going to be an actress, but it failed.
Wow.
Yeah, I took improv lessons. I just really like to perform. And I think we're all like this in a way that it allows an outlet for you to become someone that you're not so you can escape whatever it is that you want to escape and become that other person.
Mm-hmm.
So through that journey, and I worked at CTV for 10 years and I did, I did production and I had an office job. And then I also, I did acquisitions during the day. And then one of the producers at Discovery Channel let me host a show. And so in that process, I figured out what it was that I loved so much about this industry, and it was stories. So then I started storytelling, and I'm a super nosy person. Like anyone who knows me, everywhere we go, I am listening to the conversation beside me or watching how some drama unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to know how things work and why people do what they do and how they got where they are. I just recently started a job in aviation, and the reason I'm loving it so much is because I know nothing about it right now. And
yes, I saw that. So give us a little background about how this whole aviation industry is and how you got into it. Because from television, being at Rogers, from writing to moving into aviation, where did that transition?
I don't know. No. So I went back to school a couple years ago. I was hosting my show on Rogers with my background at CTV, and I was trying to figure out, because I've been home with my kids too most of the time, I was trying to figure out how can I reinvent myself. I can't go back to exactly what I was doing because I'm not the same person I was before I became a mother.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually went to the college and I asked for help. I went to see a career counselor and I was like, what do I do? I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, we did some of those self-assessments and everything pointed me towards PR.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know what PR was. And the more I read about it, the more I realized that's exactly where I wanted to be. It's still media, but it's a different form of media. It's still storytelling, but sometimes on behalf of an organization or a specific person. So I took the program, no idea where I was going to go with it. And halfway through the program, we had to write a letter to ourselves saying, you know, what we wanted to say to ourselves once we had graduated and what our hopes were for the future. Mm-hmm. And that day I had watched, one of my professors had given us this, he was showing us good PR campaigns and how powerful they can be. And so we had watched all of the Christmas campaigns, the giving campaigns from WestJet.
Yes, yes.
I don't know if you've seen them. And I've seen those. I was a complete wreck. Everyone's looking at me laughing.
I know, they are so emotional. Yes. I've seen a few and cried.
So I wrote my letter, and it was a couple weeks after that. I wrote my letter to myself, and, you know, I was like, no matter what you're doing, I'm so proud of you, and look at you go. And one of the things I wrote was, try to get yourself into a campaign like WestJet, because that's where you belong, telling stories, making an impact, and doing what you love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I graduated, and 2 weeks after I graduated, I went into this job at the airport. And I was like, I don't even belong in an airport. What am I doing here? I should be doing all these other interviews that I, you know, like a PR agency where I know I belong.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got that letter came that night, and I opened it, and it said the WestJet. And I was like, oh my gosh, like I feel like everything's coming full circle right now. And then I was offered the job there. So it just, it came at a perfect time because I didn't even know what I was doing at that interview. I just kind of promoted who I was, and I mm-hmm. sold what I do mm-hmm. and hoped that it worked for them. And in the process, it was more of an events position that they were looking for. Mm-hmm. They created another position for me to keep me happy, but also they realized that there was, you know, a hole to fill there, that they hadn't been doing a lot of storytelling, and they mm-hmm. didn't see it through you know, through my eyes. The way I saw it was mm-hmm. I wanted to know what was happening behind the scenes.
For sure.
I had no idea that only 6% of pilots are female. So that was my big thing that I wanted to focus on and start getting those stories out into trade publications, into local media, and, start finding those role models for, because I have three daughters as well, that mm-hmm. there is no industry that's untouchable for women.
Absolutely. You know? And I think absolutely.
Aviation is one of those ones that girls just think, pilots are men, mm-hmm. right? And so they don't go into it. So, but I've met some really cool female pilots along the way.
So have you tried the aviation?
Do I fly? Is that what you're asking me?
Pretty much.
Well, that's a funny story. I'm actually terrified of flying. I have a really, really hard time on planes. And they have offered to take me out a couple times. And I'm like, just, you know what? It's my job here to have a good reputation.
I'll stay on the ground.
Yeah. I'd rather not throw up into a bag and have to go back to work after that. So no, I haven't yet. But the neat thing is the more I become absorbed in that industry, the more I'm looking forward to my next flight. You know, there's so many safety standards and there's so much that goes into it that your fear needs to hear those things.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And you've been in the industry, in the media, and PR has been a new venture for you. So where does the past and the present stand today in media and the PR industry? Do you see there's a transition that's taken place, the kind of news we put out today?
I mean, when I started in media, I'm going to age myself, but there wasn't any social media at the time. So, I didn't take journalism. I wasn't going in it to become, you know, a news reporter by any means. I loved behind the scenes. And then I loved just hosting the fluff, the entertainment stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what I can see that has changed is everyone's a reporter now, right? So the news is delivered by everyone. And mm-hmm. so you've got people who are taking videos and reporting on things that are happening in the community, even sometimes before media outlets are doing it. So
mm-hmm.
it's certainly changed a lot. And I think that's why a lot of, especially with community media, as you know, mm-hmm. the focus has really become storytelling and finding those stories, because we all can kind of tell those stories on our own. But I think that we're overwhelmed with all of the negativity that we see in our social media feeds mm-hmm. and also in the news, that we really want those positive stories and we want that inspiration. And for me, I find it even in, you know, my own friends. I was sitting and having dinner with a friend of mine the other day, and she was a CEO of a big company, and mm-hmm. she left. and just decided she just wants to stay home. And so, you know, I find so much inspiration in those stories because you're constantly knocking yourself down compared to other people.
Sure.
And people that you thought have it all really are just looking for maybe something mundane, you know? Mm-hmm. The other thing that I was thinking of recently was, I feel like there's this huge transition where, you know, my mother's generation were fighting for those CEO positions, and our generation is looking to take a step back again. The stories that I'm telling are mostly, you know, women who want to take that step back, who want to find what matters, who want to spend more time with their children, and that, you know, that has changed so much.
Mm-hmm.
I know,
and take care of themselves too, right? Mm-hmm. That is huge too. People mm-hmm. have kind of started to slow down that pace that all of us have gotten into this rat race with mm-hmm. life.
And I mean, we were talking about this before the show as well, but all the anxiety and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're all dealing with that right now and looking for opportunities to take a step back.
Absolutely.
One of the biggest obstacles I've faced in my career has been my own negative self-talk.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for, like I said, for as long as I can remember, I wanted to sing, I wanted to act, I wanted to perform, I wanted to interview, but my fears were always holding me back. And I think at the beginning of my career, when I was 20 years old at CTV, I hid all of that because God forbid anybody know what was really going on in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're all at a stage where we're openly talking about it, which helps so much, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You decided to take this big leap and go back to school, which not many people do
yeah.
that at this point with a career. You have a family to manage. How did that happen?
Honestly, I think it also plays into my insecurities, right? I didn't feel like I could jump back into an industry that I had left for so long
mm-hmm.
And be confident. So I just needed to build my confidence. The funny thing is, I walked into a room full of people who were half my age and realized, like, I was a giant eyesore and I needed to fit in. And so it kind of made my insecurities a little worse for a while. But honestly, I had like, I laughed so hard every day that my face hurt and I realized I was exactly where I belonged, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's life, right? Like
mm-hmm.
if you can either sit at home and say you can't, or you can force yourself out there and be super uncomfortable for a while
mm-hmm.
and then realize you can, and it was worth it, and I'm worthy, and I do have something to offer, you know?
Absolutely.
I think, having not just the people who are half my age accept me, but also, you know, my professors say, yeah, you know, you're a great writer, or
mm-hmm.
or you certainly should be in this industry. Just constantly having. So, I mean, my point is, going back to school, it was different. I mean, I don't really know anyone else in my generation who's doing it right now, but
mm-hmm.
it was so worth it for me, and I have no regrets.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 100% certain of where I belong now.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely sharpened my skills because, as you know, media is constantly changing.
It is.
Yeah. So, so now I can walk in there and kind of feel like, yes, I get it and I can do it. And,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to have to go Google it and fake it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though I could have for free, right? But I don't regret it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in balancing the school year and also your job and everything, did you take time to breathe and relax and say, okay, now, you know, I just need my time, because it can overwhelm you at some point.
I'm terrible at meditating. I'm terrible at slowing down. I don't know how to do it. I've tried so many times, and then it's just something else I've failed. So I don't really do it much anymore. The one thing that I do that helps is I run
mm-hmm.
and it just gives me time away from, you know, the messy house and the chaos of three children and all that goes with that. And, you know, deadlines that I may have, I give myself an hour to run, and I could really solve the world's problems while I'm running.
Mm-hmm.
And also it exhausts me physically, so, you know, that I am forced to settle down after, and, you know, maybe.
So you found your way. And you have some goals that you've set for yourself in terms of, you know, where you want to see the industry going, or even the organization you've started, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little about that.
So, I mean, when I graduated, I thought that I would want to go full time into an industry working, you know, as a communicator for that organization. But I decided that I wanted to try and balance all of the things that I love at the same time. And I got really lucky with the Waterloo Region Airport, because they supported that. So my position allows me to continue to host in studio and to write for Kitchener Today and tell those local stories. And I think it's a win for all of us because, like we've said, there's so many amazing people in this, in the region. And I never want to give that up. I never want to give up meeting those people and telling those stories, but also creating those relationships for me.
Absolutely.
Right? I love that. So so my future, I think, always will include some form of storytelling, whether it be, you know, on camera or writing. And who knows where the aviation thing will take me.
And in doing these storytellings and meeting people, what has hit you the most in your life and how you function day to day listening to their stories? So how has that helped you as a person?
I mean, this again, it goes back to confidence, right? I mean, once you start talking to people, even the ones who seem like they're, you know, intellectually above me or more successful, once you start talking to them and getting to know them and forming a relationship, even through an 8-minute interview, you get to know a lot about a person and you realize we're all the same, right? We are all,
isn't that
deep
so
down,
true?
We're all the same and we're all dealing with maybe the same, not with the exact same fears, but some level of fear that we might fail or that our past will catch up with us or that people will figure out who we really are, you know? And I mean, we're just trying so hard. And especially I find with social media, we're trying so hard to be what we think is shareable or important or, you know, worth following or engaging in, that sometimes we forget who we are and we're less authentic. So when I'm doing these interviews and I'm talking to these people in the community, that's what I'm trying to find, is what makes them unique. What is their story and how are we all similar, you know? Like, for example, Miss Oktoberfest, when I interviewed her, the interview looks like it's going to be, how did it feel when you won? And what do you plan to do with your year? But instead, our entire interview hinged on how she didn't feel like she was good enough. And she, in her mind, said, I can't do this. How am I going to fill these shoes? And she actually waited until the deadline and didn't submit and had a friend tell her, you need to do this. And so she, like, literally, like, 5 minutes before the deadline, put in her application and thought nothing of it. So for me, it's those stories that that person out there says, I'm not good enough. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go for this job. I'm not going to submit this whatever application to, you know, become whatever it is they want to be because their mind is telling them no. Just try it, right? You never know.
You never know. So what do you think makes Waterloo region unique from all the years of experience you've had, the transition you've seen?
Well, can I say the annoying construction it took to get?
Absolutely.
I was almost late. Well, you know, I mean, I lived in Waterloo. I grew up in Waterloo region. And then I went to London to go to school. And then I lived in Toronto for 10 years when I worked at CTV. And what makes it unique is that I've always been a city girl. I wouldn't do very well in the country, especially in the winter. But when I went to Toronto, I felt lost, right? I didn't feel unique. So when I had children, the first, my instinct said go home. So I came home to raise my children here. And I think what I love most about Waterloo region is there's so many opportunities, but it's not a big city like Toronto, right? So my children can walk to school and I feel safe with that and play outside and still have, you know, access to Toronto and other cities that we can get to easily, but we still feel like a small town, you know, and I still feel like I'm at home when I'm here.
Absolutely.
And but at the same token, we have, you know, two universities and a college and we have, you know, tons of media opportunities and different organizations, you know, the tech industry. So we, there's so much that we have here, but it just doesn't feel like a big city to me.
True. Population has definitely grown in this region from the time, you know, I've been here myself. And it seems to be growing at a faster pace.
Yeah. Well, Well, especially with all the LRT stuff that's happening, right? It's a little confusing driving around in the city right now.
For sure. But yeah. Like you said, this region does have a lot of opportunities. It's a city that's growing and growing at a fast pace.
Well, and the great thing for me and for you is there's so many stories to tell.
Exactly.
Right? You'll never run out of stories. No.
No.
Lots of inspirational people.
And people are always ready to share their story now because they know it can make a difference in someone's life. Bring it out and share it with someone. Even if it makes a difference in that one person's life, it's a big win.
I do have a lot of volunteer too with local charities. Mm-hmm. And so I'll do media relations or I'll do event planning or whatever it is that they need from me. And the one thing that I really love is it's not hard work because people in our community want to give back. They want to hear about opportunities to help. I work specifically with an organization that helps children with cancer. It's called Pediatric Oncology Group of Ontario. And so there's a run that happens. And I mean, they raised $70,000 last year just in Kitchener-Waterloo. Mm-hmm. And then I ran an event through my daughter's school this year for the same organization.
Interesting you're saying that because my next guest next week is from the pediatric.
Okay. Yes. So we raised $5,000 in one school and Pogo said that was the most they've ever raised in a school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with our run here. We raise the most money out of any event in Ontario.
Fabulous.
So that says a lot about Waterloo Region, right?
It does. Mm-hmm. It does, definitely. So what is the one message you would like to give our listeners to follow their dreams, be it media, PR, or whatever it is that they aspire to be and do?
Mm-hmm.
What would your message be to them?
I think we need to get out of our own heads, right? So I feel like you gotta just try. And I mean, sometimes the best thing you can do is find that person that believes in you and ask them and let them be the person who talks you into it and who pushes you toward it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, if you're like me, you're going to find reasons why you can't. And, oh, it's too much work, or, you know, I'm not smart enough for that or whatever. But everybody has that person in their life that'll say, you can do it. Mm-hmm. You're worth it. Look at all the things you've done. And just avoid all that negative self-talk and keep pursuing. Because, you know what, no regrets, right? We only live once.
Absolutely. Natasha, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here in studio today. And thank you so much for sharing your journey and inspiring people who are listening.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with my next guest, Joanna Rickett Hall.
Hello. And those who have just tuned in, you are listening to In Conversation with Rashmi with Joanna Rickett Hall and Natasha McKenty on CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. My second guest this morning is Joanna Rickett Hall, a well-known social historian whose research interest focuses mainly on Waterloo County, its people, and their little-known stories that include Black history, local Indigenous history, and even more supernatural themes. Passionate about sharing the past with new audiences, Joanna has developed and taught courses in local history at Conestoga College and Wilfrid Laurier University. In honor of her contributions in this area, she even received the 2015 Jane Steckley Award for Excellence in Heritage Education from the Waterloo Region Heritage Foundation. Over the years, Joanna has worked at several local museums where she has been an interpreter, curator, and program development consultant. She is commonly found facilitating at historic workshops in period costume, baking bread over an open fire, or just telling stories. Most recently, Joanna has written a new book entitled Waterloo You Never Knew, Life on the Margins, which just released in June of 2019. It is available through all of the normal online channels like Amazon, Indigo, and even locally at Wordsworth Books in Uptown Waterloo. Thank you so much, Joanna, for joining me in studio this morning. It's an absolute pleasure again, and it's an early morning, but thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and actually I'm an early riser, so this is just perfect.
That's great. So what sparked your interest in history to begin with?
Oh, that's hilarious, considering I grew up and I hated history. History was so boring to me, like, why would anybody study history?
Yes.
And the ironic thing is as I would say, as I started to get older, I realized that everything I'd done was history. In other words, yesterday was history, even if it was, you know, watching a TV program, whatever it was. And I came to understand that the stories that people would tell me or that I would tell other people were also in the realm of history. Mm-hmm. And little by little, I would say, layer after layer, I realized I wanted to know more about the people that came before me, mm-hmm. and uncover maybe some salacious details about them.
And in doing so, how long back before you decided, okay, Waterloo region has a lot of history and this is what I'm going to start doing?
Well, again, that's actually kind of funny, because in terms of history, I always thought, oh, okay, you know, the Vikings, or, you know, maybe ancient Egypt, all those fun, you know, big histories. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, one day, one of the relatives on my dad's side made mention, oh, did you know that our family came here in 1802? And I'm like, 1802, that's like forever ago. And then I realized, wait a minute, if I'm looking at Egypt, wait a minute. And I started to ask a few more questions in the family, and I realized there was an awful lot of stories that weren't being told, even just within our own family. And mm-hmm. I started to share that with other people, and I realized everybody had a horse thief, or, you know, somebody who was against the, you know, during the Reformation or something. There were stories out there. Mm-hmm. And then it dawned on me one day that all history is local history. We just happen to promote things like the Vikings or the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. Sure, they're interesting, but so are our local histories as well.
And you also wrote about the laundry day was no push button miracle in the 1850s. Tell me a little about that.
Well, one of the things, I guess I'm going to go back to what Natasha had said about how she remembers the time that there was no social media. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm actually going to take issue with that, because we've always had social media, meaning it just took a different form. You might have had the town crier going through town, or you know, somebody coming through from another village, maybe delivering mail. There were mm-hmm. always stories being carried. Mm-hmm. And in the same way with technology, and you think of your laundry, yes, believe me, I think if I went back in time, I would miss things like hot water on the ready, and certainly being able to push that button to do the laundry and walk away. So laundry back then might have been a two-day affair. You're mm-hmm. washing today, drying it, and then tomorrow is when you either iron or mend.
When you were also a part of the Joseph Schneider home, where you actually enacted these scenes with costumes, where you told the history of where things began, and how did that start?
Well, I can explain maybe, think of it this way. When you go to a history site where people are in costumes, there's different ways of interpreting the past. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you'll have a first person interpretation where somebody comes in and goes, I'm Mrs. So-and-so. Mm-hmm. And you only answer questions based on your version or your script of that life. That can be very restrictive. I did work mm-hmm. at a village in the States. And when I say village, I mean museum village.
Right.
And we did that. But there's also second person, where you are talking, or even third person, you're talking in a broader context. Mm-hmm. And that's where it takes on even more of a storytelling format. So in terms of an acting, it isn't so much an act as it is a practice and an art. You mm-hmm. learn skills. Mm-hmm. So if I'm at an open hearth and I'm making bread, I'm actually making bread. It'd be no different than if you were Mrs. So-and-so making the bread for your family. So you're mm-hmm. actually doing those activities that you would have done back in the day.
Making bread would include the recipes they used at that time that you
would? Yeah, for the most part. Mm-hmm. In fact, my coworkers often have laughed at me, because some of the younger folk would be looking at the recipes, and of course, by my age, I just get out the pot and I start doing things. So, I mean, on one hand, that in and of itself is, I think, an interpretive activity between mm-hmm. the two generations, because the older generation would have been doing it alongside the younger, and in a mentorship fashion would be teaching them. Absolutely. So that's really how you get the evolution of recipes, because mm-hmm. somebody wasn't there to actually show someone mm-hmm. how to make something. And so even with the baking of the bread, we're even doing our yeast ourselves.
That's amazing. And tell me a little about the 19th century black settlement in Waterloo region. That was huge.
Yeah, actually it was. Many people don't know that story. In fact, I'm actually quite surprised how little people realize our area of Waterloo region has been a multicultural tableau since its, millennia, mm-hmm. right? We have our indigenous peoples that have been here. The Black folks actually came here in and around the same time that most people are aware of the Mennonites that came. Mennonites were passive abolitionists, so often would bring other people with them. And by other people, I mean other religions, in this case, other culture groups. Mm-hmm. And so although many of the Blacks were also escaping the bonds of slavery in the States, at the same point, some came also as laborers and were working as employees of the Mennonites that came here too. So it wasn't just, a fleeing of slavery. Mm-hmm. It was also folks that came here with jobs.
Were they accepted in the community like any, because they've gone through hardship even here?
Absolutely. I don't want to diminish that story at all. In fact, many were indeed refugees, again, just like we have our stories now of modern day refugees coming and becoming part of the community and bringing their stories with them. But I think what I would like to point out is in the early days of this community, many of these folks were being treated and helped no different than if they were anybody else in the community. Now, that's not, no story is an absolute. So certainly there were still folks that weren't accepting. But equally, that could be said for any other group. And I can tell you that the Mennonites would often help some of these folks that had nothing. They would lend them tools. They'd lend them seeds. Mm-hmm. They would help them. And I say the Mennonites mostly because they were the predominant group. And as pacifists, they have a more egalitarian attitude towards helping others.
And the 1820 Log Schoolhouse, that has a pretty dark story behind it, just in terms of how the kids, whether they had the option of going to school or not. Tell me about that.
This is kind of interesting. I've loved that schoolhouse since I first started looking into it. And actually, I started to do the history of that. I was on a municipal heritage committee at the time, and we were kind of pushing to get it designated. And as I looked into it, I realized that was a perfect example. Part of my background is heritage planning, so it was a perfect example of repurposing. It started as a school, became a home, and then now it's a relic sitting, I always say, a silent sentinel in Waterloo Park. So it's actually moved three times. But it started as a school built by the Pennsylvania German Mennonite settlers. Abraham Erb donated the land for the school. And from there, it was a school until they found that it was too small. So it was dismantled, and a stone school was built over by where McGregor School is today. Mm-hmm. And so this home was rebuilt, actually, I was trying to think, reassembled over by where KCI and Central Fresh Markets are. Oh. And a gentleman by the name of Levi Carroll, which was really my first guy that I became encapsulated with. He was an ex-slave from Maryland, and he lived there with off and on. I mean, he outlived three wives. Mm-hmm. But so three times he created a family in that place. And wow. If anyone's been up there, it's a small building. At one point, he even rented some space to a tenant while he was living there too with his family. And so I guess what I'm saying is by the point that it went to the park, it three times when they moved it, each time it was like, oh, this is just old, let's get rid of it. But someone in the community rallied. And by the point that it ended up in Waterloo Park, people realized this is a valuable building. Mm-hmm. I mean, you wouldn't have buildings if people didn't build them. So there's always a story.
And the school system at that time was very different too, where it was voluntary, whether you want to go to school or not, and the teachers who taught at the school as well. Tell us a little about that history, because that seems a little fascinating in terms of how the education system then was.
Right. It's a little different than the way we think of school today. Mm-hmm. The fact that the Mennonites had built this school, keep in mind that many of them were German-speaking, even though they also spoke English, and in some cases German, German, but also French, because many were from the Palatinate region that we think of also as the Alsace-Lorraine. So many of these boundaries geographically did change over time. So they were multilingual, but primarily this was a school that was instructing in German. It was the language, the vernacular that they spoke. And so therefore, when they create the school, they didn't have a curriculum like we're used to. I mean, that type of thing hadn't been written. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it was, I'm going to say a private school. I don't mean a private school in the same sense we think of private school today. Mm-hmm. It's that these folks recognized their children needed education. Almost like how we think of homeschool today, they're going to take care of the education for their mm-hmm. kids. They build the school. One of the well-known figures, Bishop Benjamin Eby, he wrote a lot of the early educational materials like a speller and that type of thing for the kids. So it was very self-contained that way. And in terms of who the teachers were, they came from the community. Some themselves were farmers. And that might sound funny too, but when you consider that early school was really only taking place in the winter, mm-hmm. What are farmers doing during the winter? Well, maybe they're doing, you know, some repairs in the barn or something like that, but the point is they're not out in the field planting, so they find other things to do. And education, even though many of these folks were going to what would be the equivalent of about grade 8, mm-hmm. education was still important to them. So absolutely. Learning your math, learning how to read, write, and certainly the Bible would have been one of their, I guess, really historical but also religious books they would use in the classroom as well.
Wow. And about your book, what you have written, can you tell me a little about that?
Sure. A little bit? No.
Yes. I know the history.
I can wax poetic forever on that. Let me put it to you this way. So when the idea first came, it came through a breakfast meeting, but once I was speaking to the publisher to make a proposal, mm-hmm. the format of the book came very clear in my head because I was looking at a collection of stories. I wanted to traverse roughly the 200 years of the community to get, you might say, from then to now. And, you know, I wanted to look at themes. So I looked at things like containment, and that's, you know, what today we might know maybe as some social programming. So institutions, things like that, which would have also included education. But some of the earlier stories as well, you know, there's the one about cholera coming to the area. I mean, today mm-hmm. we hear a lot about, you know, there's various arguments about vaccines and disease and the spread of disease. And so one of the stories in the early part of the book is talking about how disease spread so quickly, they almost didn't really know what hit them. But then I always include, well, what did they do with that?
Yes.
And I guess this is the lesson that I try to have as a theme throughout the book, is that rather than giving up or giving in to the problem, they found strategies. Mm-hmm. And in the case, there was about a quarter of the population in the Galt area alone that had died as a result of cholera coming in. And oftentimes, widows would marry widowers. So what I'm saying is families would blend. And there was strength in, you know, looking at your neighbor in a different way. And I don't mean, you know, obviously marrying them, but I mean in terms of a survival, you know, rather than leaving somebody on their own to drift and not be able to fend for themselves, people mm-hmm. banded together. And I think that is a theme that for me in this community, you know, there are people that suffer, of course there are, but there's equally, you know, as Mr. Rogers would say, look for the helpers. There's mm-hmm. also a lot of helpers in this community, and there mm-hmm. are many people. I mean, just right off the bat, I think of the working center and how much work they've done throughout
absolutely.
The community.
You talked about how the community came together and, you know, the neighbors knew each other. So they did have that bond, and isolation, was that a huge part in those days like it's seen today?
There's a lot I could unpack in that term isolation. I mean, on one hand, you have folks who are introverts and actually mm-hmm. they don't see isolation at all. If anything, they see that as empowerment because then they can quiet their minds and focus on other things.
Sure.
So on the other hand, isolation, sometimes there's strength in these groups. I mean, even today you still have very productive Mennonite and or Amish communities. I mean, there's many other types of communities, but just to use mm-hmm. them as groups that are well known in this area, I mean, they still contribute. They're still coming into the community to either sell their produce from their farms, or they might be coming in to purchase They're also coming into the hospitals. So what I'm saying, there's still a certain amount of interaction, but they are still somewhat self-isolating. And sometimes that's even a protection, you know, like how many times are we, and by protection, I'll get to that. You know, we talk about, for example, kids today, you hear from people, oh, get those kids off the electronics or whatever. Well, every time there's a stop put in place, that can be a form of isolation. I mean, even censorship is a form of isolation. It's shutting it down something. And it can be good, it can be bad, just depends on its use. So I guess that's kind of, I'm in the middle on that, whether isolation for these community groups was good or bad. Kind of a very circuitous answer, but.
For sure. Yeah. In terms of the book you've written, you've spoken about the famous, the infamous, the marginalized groups. There is a part of the indigenous story in there as well. Tell me a little about that.
Well, you know, I can remember when I first was teaching a history program in this area. And, you know, I guess I was just as unconscious as many can be. I just started teaching the history as I knew it. And what did I know? Of course, the white narrative. And I was running with that. And one day I thought to myself, that's horrible, because they weren't the only people here. You know, I made a joke earlier before we were on air, and I said, if you don't like kale, why are you eating kale? It's kind of the same thing. If I know there's other people here, why am I not sharing their stories? And then it became kind of a personal mission for me to get honest with what I'm teaching with history, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the magnificent. In other words, tell all the stories. Some of these stories may not be mine to tell, because in Indigenous circles, you need permission to tell the stories. That's why I try very hard to be respectful and only kind of give, you know, a little look behind the veil and a little bit of some of the facts of the history, because there are many more empowered and really better storytellers within the Indigenous community. These are their stories. So I don't want to overstep them. But I think people need to know there's a lot more going on here than what you've been told in school. The history you were taught in public school, and or I'm going to assume in the separate school system, is not
the same
history. No, there's a lot more going here. A lot of people belong that we never thought were even here.
And you teach at Wilfrid Laurier? You teach history there. So when you're teaching there and the kids these days listen to what the history then was and where things have transitioned, what are the kind of curious questions that come up?
Well, I will tell you, I do teach a lot of adult education as well, but when I've taught younger kids, and of course I walk into the room and they look at me and they're like, oh great, so we're in a history course and we're being taught by a dinosaur. This is just going to end very poorly. You know, many times I've started off the semester by saying, okay, we're just going to do an exercise. How many people here know technology? And I'm holding up my phone. Of course, every hand in the room very arrogantly goes up, and I'm like, oh, okay. So if your phone breaks, how do you fix it? And always there's some sarcastic person in the class that goes, well, I'll just go to like Apple or whatever, you know, something. And I go, oh, okay, that's fine. But something's happened that you have to fix it yourself. And they all look at me blank and they're like, I don't know how to do that. And I go, history's no different.
Absolutely.
Okay. You are consumers of your technology. All right. I'm here to talk about those that created it. And that's what history really is about. Those ideas that bring us to where we are today.
Where, if people need to reach and get your book from and follow what you're doing, where can they find you?
I mean, they could.
I know you have a Twitter account that people can follow you.
Yeah, they could follow me on Twitter at J. Rickard Hall. And I mean, I am on Facebook with my name, but I've also got the blog that I am very remiss sometimes to keep up with, but I'm still around. I still get emails through there, and that's logschoolhouse.blogspot.ca.
And your book can be bought online?
Yep, it can be bought online. It's available at Wordsworth Books in Uptown Waterloo. I always want to support local businesses, and I've been told it's also at Costco, at well, both Costcos.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Joanna, for sharing with our listeners the amazing history of this region and helping us understand and look at this land we are from a different perspective. So thank you for joining me this morning.